Welcome to another edition of Lying on the Beach. I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman.
And today our extra special guest is someone I've known for a very long time, Steve Rothaus. If you don't know the name, you should. He has been a fixture on the Miami Herald for about 30 years, covering the LGBTQ issues for at least, I'd say, two decades of that 30 years, if not more. He'll give us some of the specifics. I know his news team has been involved with a million different awards from those from GLAAD and from other organizations as well. And Steve is unique in that he may be the first, or at least one of the first, to actually get the beat of covering the gay and lesbian community. And he's been doing it for a very long time, has seen and covered it all. And it's an honor, Steve, to have you as part of our podcast today. Thank you for joining us.
Well, Steve, Lois, thank you very much for asking me to be here.
My first question is, why do you think, when you think of the entire country, you think of the New York Times, you think of the LA Times, you think of San Francisco, why did Miami step up and say, hey, we want to cover the gay and lesbian community and we want to have a full-time person doing it? Why did they do it so early on in the process? Why do you think that was something the Herald wanted to do?
Well, I'm not sure the Herald actually thought about doing it until I said this is something we need to do. Basically, I've been at the Herald. I started in November of 1985 as a part-timer while I was at college. I was at Florida International University. I was out practically from the time I started at the Herald. So I was always somebody who was a go-to person that they could ask me about, what I thought of a story, or I would write a story, or I'd look at a headline, and they always trusted me to, what I thought and my opinion as an out gay man. There weren't many other people in the industry at that time, certainly in the mid-80s, people who were out, people who were, working their way up into the business. They were closeted. And, but I came out early because I was more comfortable to be out. I was just more comfortable that they know who my partner was, that I could be myself. And so I basically said, this is who I am. And I shared that very early on in my career.
Steve, why do you think the Miami Herald was so open to do that, where other newspapers would take 10 years to make a decision like that?
Well, to begin with, let me just set this up so you know why and how and the timing on this. In the summer of 1997, Johnny Versace was killed on the steps of his mansion on Ocean Drive. Okay, the Miami Herald couldn't keep up with the international press that descended on Miami the summer of 1997 to cover what was one of the biggest stories of the year, because the Herald just didn't have the sourcing and it didn't have the resources to be able to go after a story like that. So within the first week or so, it became clear that there was a community that was uncovered in the city of Miami, in Miami. Some of the editors came to me and they said, Steve, we're trying to figure out what can we do. We would like to be able to cover this community in some way. Would you be interested in writing stories? And I said, I would be very interested in writing stories about the LGBT community. I said, but with one condition. And they asked me what that was. And I said, that these stories run the full run of the Miami Herald. I was not interested in writing stories that would run only in Miami Beach, or only in the neighborhoods that they thought, this is where the gay people are. I wanted to write for the entire run. And back then, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of readers every day. Mm-hmm. So, they agreed to that. And I said, great. And we started, and it began as a twice a month column that ran in the suburban section of the paper, but it was zoned only in terms of circulation. It had to run everywhere. So, a column might run one day in Neighbors, which was the suburban section, you know, on Thursday and maybe on Sunday in the Keys, and it had to run in Palm Beach. We had editions all over the state. So that's how it began, and it took off very quickly because it was so different. It was so, you know, it was just not done anyplace. You know, there were people who that I knew who were writing editorials, LGBT editorials, or people who were by the early 90s covering the HIV/AIDS epidemic. But there really was no one covering a community of people outside of AIDS. And that's what, you know, what I did that was different from anybody else.
And do you think Miami in general has always been sort of a hotbed for the gay community, where there's like Anita Bryant going back a bunch of decades?
Well, exactly. Right. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, this past summer, as everyone was talking about Stonewall, and I would speak and tell people, you know, Stonewall obviously, you know, holds a moment in American history, LGBTQ history, as a time in which the community, the gay community, kind of got together for the first time politically and acted out and got, you know, obviously major attention. I said, but, you know, what I believe is that Miami became the true ground zero for gay rights and the gay rights movement in the United States, because in 1977, that was when Miami-Dade County passed one of the early gay rights ordinances that prohibited discrimination on the basis of sexual or affectational preference. And you know, within 2 weeks, Anita Bryant, who was the Florida Orange Juice spokeswoman, came to the commission and she said, if you pass this, we're going to repeal it. We're going to take it down. And within 3 weeks of that, of passing the ordinance, you know, by going to churches on Sundays, they had enough petitions signed that it actually got on the ballot. And for the next 5 months, this story played out not just in Miami, but all over the country. And where Stonewall, to me, was a story that, you know, people within the LGBT community may have known about it. People within the New York community might have known about it. But people in the middle America, they weren't talking about Stonewall. But they were talking about what was happening in Miami. They were talking about Anita Bryant. They were talking about, you know, Walter Cronkite doing his 6:37 o'clock news talking about gay rights. So suddenly, this became a talk story everywhere, and everybody had an opinion.
And there were so many activists on both sides that were so vocal. It was such, you know, Miami really is the incubator for all of those issues.
Well, you know, not just gay rights, but as a result of that, as a result of Anita Bryant, we saw the beginnings of the Christian Coalition. And we're talking about 1977, now into 1978, so that by the time Ronald Reagan ran in 1980, you had a full-fledged coalition of conservative religious activists who, you know, they stood behind him and helped him get elected.
You know,
I mean,
Steve,
this was
over
the dawn of that.
And it's really, I mean, you and I have both kind of lived through so much of this here in South Florida that it's amazing that it all happened during our lifetime. But, you know, I wonder, over the years, have you had a lot of pushback from readers or people in the street or whatnot? Has there been any repercussions in a negative way, or has it only been just love and appreciation?
Oh, no. I mean, when I first started covering LGBT, to begin with, you know, we decided in the beginning that instead of just simply running a byline on reported stories, we were going to run what we call a column sig. So it was my picture. It was done, presented to print audiences the way you would present a column, where it was a person's face and their name and then the story, even though these were reported stories. And the reason why I wanted to do it that way was because I wanted people in the community to know that I was a real person. I wanted them to know that, you know, I was accessible. But I also believed that if I ran my name and my picture with every story, that it would be easier for other people to be comfortable to work with me so that their pictures could be in the paper, that their names could be. I wasn't asking anything of anyone else that I wasn't prepared to do myself. I mean, I grew up in this town. I moved to Miami in high school, and I went to college here. And, you know, it's the only place I've really lived my entire adult life. So, I mean, this is my home. My family was here. My grandparents were here. So, I mean, I really thought it was important. And it was, because back in the beginning, back in the late 1990s even, that it was difficult to, you know, get people to go on the record. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I made it a goal for myself was that I would not run stories with just first names, without made up names. I mean, every story that I wrote had to have a real person with a real voice and a real name and somebody who was willing to have their picture in the paper. And, you know, that's what, you know, that's what humanized all this. These were not nameless, faceless people.
Was that difficult getting people to cooperate?
You know, there were times when I would go through entire interviews with people, and then they'd get to the end of the interview, and then suddenly they would say, oh, I just can't do this. You know, I'm looking to get a job. And I'd say, well, I understand that. I said, but I can't use your quotes. I can't use you for the story. I'm going to have to find somebody else. And that's what I would do. I would have to work to find people who were prepared and willing to go on the record with their names.
It really should be a movie about you and what you did, really, just like Harvey Milk. I mean, really. I mean, there's probably so many things that you don't remember that would have such an influence on life or give people a true perspective of what happened so that going forward that they would have the courage to do these things as well. It's pretty amazing. But I think
it is amazing.
Yeah. Steve is also talking about, did you ever walk around where somebody, like, you know, threw a pail of water at you because they didn't want to know about?
Right. I mean, so obviously, I mean, people were very taken back by what I was doing, by the Herald's presentation of this column. The publisher, you know, received many letters. And this is in the era almost before email. I mean, but real letters that saying to fire him, that they thought this was absolutely awful. And, you know, certainly the work that I was doing was not in a vacuum. And, you know, I had support from everyone there, you know, not just at the Miami Herald, but of it, you know, I had support at Knight Ridder, which was the parent company. And
which is really
there were people,
terrific.
It, you know, but I got to tell you that, you know, it's easy to say they did it and they were there for me. But, you know, the fact is that I had to push and I had to push. Yeah. It didn't happen by itself. By the time we decided that we were ready to do this, you know, even then, I mean, it was going to be something every couple of weeks. It was not a sense of a regular beat being established, and there was constant pushing. And there were people, you know, who I worked with who were less, you know, happy with us doing this kind of work. I mean, I did get pushback within the newsroom from time to time. For instance, I did a story, it was a holiday story I did of the local bear club. They were wrapping teddy bears for sick children in the hospital, you know, during the holidays. I mean, and this was, I mean, to do a story about the local bear club in the Miami Herald in the early 2000s, I mean, that was pretty daring. And we sent a photographer to take a picture of the group wrapping the photos, wrapping the bears. And, you know, it's so funny, but spontaneously, the men took off their shirts and they held up the teddy bears. And the photographer took a picture of this room full of, you know, pretty burly men with their shirts off with teddy bears. And, you know, the editors loved the photo and they ran it on the front of our features section. And one of the managing editors at the time, you know, he told the editors that he thought that, you know, it was not a wise decision, that they shouldn't have put that picture out on the front of the section. And, you know, there was nothing wrong with the picture. It was just men, you know, with big bellies and teddy bears. You know, the funny thing was that the man who complained, he looked just like all those men in the picture. So I think that maybe it had something to do with it. But, I mean, there were other times. I remember I had done a story about a gay porn star, Ryan Idle, who was doing a production of a play called Making Porn at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. This was a city-owned theater, and it had full nudity, the show. And Ryan Idle was at the end of his porn career, and he was doing this show. And, you know, he had had some pretty rough times before that, where he had thrown himself out of glass window one night on a drug high. I mean, he had nearly killed himself. This was his comeback, so to speak. And, you know, a lot of people were interested in the story. And at the time, one of the editors of a magazine in Key West called me and he said, would it be okay if we reprinted your story? And I said, well, I have no problem with that, but I have to get permission because, you know, the story is owned by the Herald. So I approached the executive editor at the time, and I said, I have a question for you. And he said, what is it? And I said, well, I've gotten a call from this magazine in the Keys. They'd like to rerun the story that I wrote. He said, oh. He said, the story I hated.
Oh, boy.
I said, yeah. He says, okay, tell them it's okay. They can run it. But, you know, that was the kind of thing that, you know, the story I hated, but yes, they could go rerun it. And it's like, fine. You know, I had a friend at the Herald who she would always say to me, just get it in the paper. Worry about it later. Get it in. Because once it's in, it's done. And she was always right. Just get it in. Deal with it later.
But Steve, it seems like you had the personality, the perfect personality, to be able to pioneer this thing, because other people would have been sensitive or annoyed or, you know, would have been disrespectful to their employer. You just did your job as a true reporter.
It.
Yeah, go ahead.
But you hit on it. You hit on it. I was doing my job. I had been trained to be a reporter. I had been a reporter at the Herald for 12 years before we actually took this on as a beat. I was already an editor. I understood what my role was there and in the community. And I knew that, you know, I couldn't cut corners. I had to treat this as exactly any other beat. And if I could do that, then I was doing my job.
Fabulous.
And that's how we did it. It was just, and the other thing to keep in mind is back in the beginning, you know, there was this sense among many editors, oh, you know, it's okay for Steve to be writing these kinds of feature stories, but we can't have him writing, you know, the politics stories, you know, the political stories, every time there's a referendum on gay rights. And why? Because, well, because he's gay and, you know, he can't be, from their perspective, I couldn't be, you know,
objective.
Impartial.
Objective. Yeah,
and it's
right.
Like, and I say, well, what? That's ridiculous. I said, you're telling me that I can't be objective because I'm gay. I said, first of all, I'm out. So I mean, it's all out there. I said, but would you tell, you know, an African American reporter that he couldn't cover, you know, civil rights? Would you tell a Hispanic reporter that she couldn't cover, you know, Cuba because, you know, she was born in Cuba and or her parents were? I said, they said, well, of course not. Well, I said, it's no different. I said, you trust me, whether it's editing the local section or, you know, writing about LGBTQ issues, you trust me just as easily for both. And it's like, you know, either you do or you don't. And
so what happened? So did, you know, what was their reaction?
They got it. They got it. And so, you know, that's why, you know, eventually, you know, when gay marriage became the big story, I mean, I covered it and I went to the court hearings. I mean, I covered it. That was, you know, of all the stories that I wrote, the one story that, you know, when people say, what was your biggest story? I would say probably that was the big story for me if I had to choose a story, because that's, you know, that was history that was being made, not just in Florida, obviously, but throughout the United States. That was being in the right place at the right time. And, you know, is it the be all and end all? Absolutely not. I mean, yes, it was a sea change. When gay people were given the same recognition by the courts, you know, for marriage, basically, you know, we could achieve anything else. We haven't yet. But, you know, when you're on that kind of equal footing legally, I mean, then, you know, then you just keep fighting for the rest.
So you never had like a drag down fight with anybody about anything, or there weren't scenes. You were just kind of mild-mannered and just made it happen. How did that work out?
Well, you know, there were no more scenes or less scenes than anybody else in that newsroom. We all had scenes from time to time. There were plenty of people who I saw slam their fists down on the desk. I did it plenty of times also, you know, slam the phone. Except when it became our phones.
Right, right.
When it was their phones, we'd slam it. I wouldn't slam my iPhone.
Right.
But, you know, it's worth fighting for. And I had other times where, you know, I absolutely would, you know, you have to pick and choose your battles, and sometimes they were the battle.
Right.
I remember one night a lesbian editor and I approached the night duty officer. And this is way back in the 90s. And we, you know, we thought that a headline that was going inside the paper at the top of a page, you know, it offended us. It referred to homosexuals in a very old style. At that point, you know, the word homosexual was not being used to describe gay people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a clinical term, but it was the kind of word that you would see in the 50s and 60s, along with perverts and you know, those kinds of words. So that kind of language. And, you know, I remember this straight white guy telling me, you know, well, I look at the headline, he says, it doesn't bother me. But we said, but it bothers us. And we're the people who would bother. Of course it doesn't bother you. But I remember those kinds of moments. They happened, you know, not a lot, but they did happen.
But it wasn't like something that you would walk out, that you would walk out and that would be the end of that.
Never. I mean, because that's not how I do business. I mean, I would never do that. First of all, I mean, your power comes from within, not from outside. If I were to walk out, then what? Somebody else would do it, or it wouldn't get done.
So what is their position today? They don't have an editor that followed you.
Well, you see, that's the thing, is that, you know, all through the years, through the 2000s into the end of the 2000s, probably around 2008, until about then, you know, it was always the thought that, for me, that I would do this and that someday I could, you know, turn it over to somebody else. But as the newspaper industry, as the media, you know, as the news industry began to contract, it became more apparent to me that it was less likely somebody would do this, because they were letting go of people. They weren't hiring people. I mean, too many people have been let go. And when you look at the people who've been let go, the people who were let go first, they were the newest hires. Well, who were the newest hires? They were mostly the people hired, you know, in, you know, all through the 2000s. And these were people, young people, people of color, Hispanic people, gay people, women. I mean, they were the minorities. They were the people. There was an initiative in my company, at least, to hire people who could fully represent the readership. But then, when they had to start to let go of people, it was the last one in, it's the first one out.
Right.
So
right.
You know, then if you get rid of everybody, who are you left with? Older white people. Who many of them, you know, most of them don't speak Spanish, or you know, they're not people of color, and they're older people that don't relate to younger people. So you completely have, you know, you don't represent your community anymore. And, you know, I got it. I mean, you know, they thought they were protecting people who might not get work.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, there was a reason why. I mean, because, you know, the people who were let go from newspapers, beginning around 2007, 2008, many of them never worked in the industry again. And if you were an older person, you know, what were you going to do? So,
and you know, the business changed so much that I remember in 89 or 90 having to bring a tape over to the Herald or something, and you'd walk into that newsroom and it was like right out of a movie. It was like filled with people and tons of action. You know, a TV newsroom is so, you know, small by comparison. And the, you know, the Herald was amazing. Those newsrooms are gone. They don't exist anymore. It's so sad.
They don't. Well, you know, and people work from home. I mean, I just got done with a day's work and I worked at home. And You know, that's what newsrooms have gotten very small, and they're located remotely. They're not, newsrooms are not in the heart of downtown anymore.
Right, right.
Because it's too expensive. I mean, that McClatchy, which became the company that absorbed Knight Ridder, they sold the Miami Herald building around 2011, and we moved out in 2013. And the building was torn down, and it's never been rebuilt. I mean, there's nothing there. It's a vacant lot that's used, for art exhibits and those kinds of things until the developers who bought the property are ready to build high rises. But it's right now there's nothing. And the Miami Herald, what it did was they bought property in west of the airport in Miami, where it was less expensive. And so they're in the city of Doral, and it's pretty, even though if you look at the map and they tell you it's the middle of Dade County, and it really is the center of Miami-Dade County, but it's not the center of government. It's not the center of, the politics of Miami-Dade County. It's just on the map, the center. So many people, to avoid the traffic, they just telecommute. And so you lose something, certainly.
One last question I want to ask you. Do you find that, has it been documented, or has anybody actually come out and said, you were the first to have this beat? Was there any, in your intro I said you were one of the first.
We always do that. Right. Well, as a journalist, you never say you're the first, or you never say you're the biggest or the best. Okay. Right. In 2016, Columbia Journalism Review did a story about me, and they described me as a pioneer, how I pioneered the business. And, they said one of the first, because, there's always somebody out there who might say they've done something. You can't say with all certainty that anybody is the first or the best or the biggest or the...
But you're the first.
But we didn't know anybody else.
Yeah, I'd say the first.
We didn't know of anybody else. No,
right.
We still don't. And I would check in with my professional organization, which is NLGJA, the National Association for LGBTQ Journalists, and I would say, gee, from year to year, did you know of anybody? No, we don't. And it's like, and one of the things that I did throughout the early 2000s, was I traveled from across the United States to newspapers, to TV stations, to college campuses where they were teaching journalism, to have the conversation with them. I did it through NLGJA, through a newsroom outreach project that I had created when I was on the national board of the organization. And, we would discuss LGBTQ issues as they pertain to coverage and the workplace. So, it gave me a pretty good opportunity to go to places where you would think they didn't need any kind of help. To go to the San Francisco Chronicle to have that conversation, you'd say, gee, what would you accomplish there? Well, you know what I accomplished? When we walked out, some of the reporters and editors said to me, Steve, you being here, we didn't know what you might, what this might be. But what we do know now is, we do a great job covering LGBT people in the city in San Francisco. But they said, we do a pretty lousy job after having this conversation. We do a lousy job covering people in the suburbs. So even they had, but I went to Omaha, Nebraska. I went to Oklahoma City. I went to Kansas City. I went to places where I didn't know anybody. And I would make these cold calls to the newsroom saying, at the time I was night business editor at the Herald, and I was saying, I'd like to come to visit you to have this conversation. And no one ever said no. And, I must say that back then, Knight Ridder was subsidizing my travel. They gave me a $10,000 annual travel budget for 2 years to be able to hold these meetings, plus the time off. That was the depth of the commitment.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. Yeah. It was amazing. And, I received beautiful emails from reporters afterwards at these papers saying, we can't believe that our newsroom would have this conversation, that we, you know, and people who came out as a result because they felt like, okay, the door has been open, they're having this conversation, and you know, these don't seem like such bad people, and so, you know, they could be themselves. But you know something, by coming out, by being yourself, it gives you, it empowers you to then be able to have a conversation about the coverage that you're doing.
Right.
I mean, it gives you the ability to say, you know, this, here's a story that I'd like to do that, you know, maybe nobody else would even think about doing that story. Or like if they saw the headline like I saw that bothered me, to say that headline bothers me. And that's why you shouldn't use it.
And also your view of the world is different. I think each person's view is different, but if you're coming from a different place, you're coming as a gay man into the world, or you're seeing the world a little bit differently, and that gives you an advantage in covering that aspect of it. I think it just is a natural, and the Herald was brave and smart to encourage it, and of course you were even braver and smarter to be the one to do it, and always, I've always thought you always were the quintessential professional, and you remain that to this day. So
thank you.
And
you know, the community embraced it. The community did embrace it. I mean, I must say that locally, nationally, you know, I won a GLAAD Media Award in 1998, which was the year after I started, you know, writing the column. And I used to joke, well, sure, it was just me and like one other person who was nominated, because back then nobody else was doing anything like that. So of course I won that award. But you know, but the fact is that through the years, you know, I've had civic groups give me awards. I've had, you know, LGBT groups give me awards. I have the Royal Palm Award from PRSA that they gave me in 2016. The college inducted me into its Hall of Fame as a journalist, you know, covering LGBT. So, you know, I've had a lot of recognition for this, and you know, it always feels like a little weird to me to be honored or recognized for doing work that you love. And you don't do it for the awards. You don't go into it to get awards. You do it because you love the work. And, you know, it's like, it comes naturally to you just to go out and do it. But then you realize you don't even think about it until they start to say, gee, this is special. This is interesting. This is different. And to say thank you. And, you know, to be able to do the work like that and never to have to compromise, and that's the other thing, not to compromise with your boss and not to compromise with the community. I mean, I remember the first time I was writing about, you know, an endorsement process by the local LGBT rights group, and they got very annoyed with me because I was asking them all these questions about how they were doing their endorsements. And they said, well, like, why are you putting us under a microscope? I said, because it's my job to do that. I said, you want coverage, you want recognition. Well, along with that, you know, comes that kind of scrutiny. And I was just doing my job.
Well, I can honestly say that from this point forward, I am going to say you were the first full-time reporter covering the gay and lesbian community with your face and name attached to it. It's an honor to know you. It's been an honor to have you on part of this podcast. And I think
thank you very much.
We're going to absolutely say a warm thank you. And hopefully maybe we'll do this again sometime soon. I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman.
And we've all been lying on the beach. So long.